Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
I'll be back in a few minutes.
Sarah Calvert, let me tell you a little bit about her. Sarah's been with us before. She is the principal in the small business attorney in her firm that's called Calvert & Associates, PC, which she started in 1991. Sarah attended Mary Washington College in Fredericksburg, Virginia, for her undergraduate studies. She got her doctorate degree from George Mason University Law School in Arlington, Virginia. She devotes her practice to providing small business clients the best legal service and business resources so they can get on with doing what they do best. And one of the things that I note about Sarah is that I like about her, because a lot of attorneys don't do this, and that is that Sarah is a very active member of her Chamber of Commerce. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. We enjoyed being here.
I want to congratulate you on working with your chamber.
Oh, well, thank you. I think they're a wonderful asset to every business owner.
Well,
I can't imagine not.
Well, I appreciate that. That's the right attitude. That is exactly the right attitude. You know, obviously, if you're going to have a small business practice, you're going to have to support the organizations that support your clients as well, and the Chamber of Commerce is one of those.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it's interesting that a lot of chambers are taking positions, a couple of positions these days that attorneys don't like. For example, tort reform.
Mm-hmm.
Many states are working on tort reform, and the chambers of commerce have to be in favor of tort reform. That's just part and parcel to their nature and to what they do to support their members. But I have actually seen chambers lose attorney membership because they took a position on tort reform or something like that, and that's very small-minded when attorneys do that. And I just want to thank you for being part of your chamber. I think that's great.
I was going to say, if you just want to say one quick thing about
sure.
that, you got to go where your pocketbook is.
Right.
And if an organization you belong to comes out with something that would injure your pocketbook and what you do for a living, I can certainly understand those few attorneys that actually do liability law being concerned about that. But if you represent businesses as a whole, you can't help but think that tort reform is going to be a useful thing, excuse me, for our small businesses, because they can't afford to be in court. They can't afford to be the victim or the prosecutor on cases like this.
Well, yeah, and you're exactly right. The thing that bothers me though is, why can't we agree to disagree on this one issue?
Sure.
And recognize that everything else that we do for the betterment of our community.
Sure, absolutely.
And so that's what bothers me. Not that they should come over to our side and be. I don't expect trial lawyers to be in favor of tort reform.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why they can't just agree to disagree with us on that one issue and continue to support our overall efforts.
That's true.
And so that's the reason why I think you stand out in the crowd. Sarah, folks, Sarah has a program called 101 Ways to Avoid Liability in a Small Business. And you know, earlier, Sarah, I was introducing you, telling the audience that you were coming up, and I actually said to keep you out of jail. I didn't mean to say that, but the truth
is
some of this stuff could land you in jail if you don't.
I always tell my clients, don't call me in the middle of the night. I don't do bail.
Yeah.
I'm not that kind of lawyer.
888-822-8255. Sarah, I think we were talking about the corporate structure
mm-hmm.
portion of your program. And one of the things I think that I'd like to talk about now is something that is number 26, and you say, are employees that have regular, substantial, undersupervised contact with your clients under a non-compete or non-solicitation agreement. Now, why is that important?
Well, I get a phone call one day when I was in business about my third year from a client who said, my best employee just walked out with my top two contracts. There's nothing left of my business. What can I do? And I said, you can wave bye-bye. Because at least in Virginia, and in many cases in many states around this area, the courts are very loath to stop somebody from competing just because they once worked for you.
Right.
There are ways of trying to stop it, and the best way to try and stop that from happening in your business is to have some sort of contract in place which is going to attempt to limit that. The best that can be said for these is that they're very expensive to enforce. However, the fact that they're in place will stop most honest people from attempting to break the contract.
Right, but now the language in these agreements, these non-compete agreements
and
non-solicitation, it has to be perfect.
It has to be absolutely perfect. If one, and literally this happens all the time, if one word is wrong or one word is too broad or too narrow, then the whole thing can be thrown out of court. and it's a horrible mess. I don't like to actually have to enforce these contracts, but when, as I said, if your goal is to hire honest employees mm-hmm. who will live up to your standards, then hopefully having these agreements with them will help them understand. The place I think they're the most fair is when you bring in somebody who's almost like an apprentice or an entry level, mm-hmm. and you train them in the business through a period of years.
Right.
When you're bringing in already skilled people and attempting to hold them to a non-compete, you're going to be much less cooperation from the courts in trying to enforce that.
But if you design the document so that it is not too broad in scope, and it has some of the right parameters, mm-hmm. and the person signs it, then you should be able to defend that.
And it is defendable. There was a big case in the beach of Virginia Beach area, the Norfolk area, of some engineering companies that were working with some of the big government contractors, and one whole engineering department left one company and went to another, and they had non-competes, and in fact, the company that received those employees, as well as those employees, all wound up paying for breaking their contract
yeah.
because the contracts were valid.
The two things that have to be paid attention to, as I remember, mm-hmm. Sarah, is the time frame and the geography.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
I would say the first thing, actually, is to define exactly what it is your company does.
Mm-hmm.
If they are a government contractor, what kinds of government contracts do they do? You can't just eliminate all government contracts.
Right.
You've got to state specifically. If you're an engineering firm, are you commercial? Are you resident? You know, what kind of work do you do?
Right.
You've got to be extraordinarily specific about what you're stopping somebody from competing against. Then you've got to say, okay, my company does this, and it does it in this area. Well, saying we do it all over the United States is not going to usually hold up.
It's too broad.
And it's too broad. You need to say exactly what geographic areas you target, even though you may have one client in California and one in Utah.
Right.
You know, we target the eastern United States or the mm-hmm. counties surrounding our headquarters by 50 miles. Those are some specific geographic languages.
The time frame, too, I mean, for a period of 6 months or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and that can't be too broad either, because if it is, the courts will say, hey, the guy's got to make a living.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Stand by, Sarah. We're going to come back close. We've got some more of this to talk to Sarah about, of her 101 ways to avoid liability in small business. If you have a question that you'd like to ask us, we've got one of the experts with us, folks, 888-822-8255. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. It's 24 after. I'm Jim Blassingame, Small Business Advocate. Thank you very much for joining us. Sarah Calvert, Small Business Attorney Extraordinaire, is our special guest. She is the principal in Calvert & Associates PC, a small business law firm. And Sarah, you have a website that I'd like for you to give us.
Oh, yes. It's www, as everybody is these days, .Calvert & Associates, all spelled out, C-A-L-V-E-R-T and Associates,
uh-huh.
.com.
All right. Thanks, Sarah. When they get there, what will they find?
Well, they're going to find some resources. That's really what we're after, is giving people resources on the web. We have a newsletter that we publish every 2 months. We have a list of our speaking engagements and our seminar topics. And we're really all about education, so that's where you'll find most of our educational materials.
Congratulations, and thank you for providing that to small business owners. That's a great service. Sarah, folks, we're talking to Sarah about 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business. And if you'd like to join us, the number is 888-822-8255. If you have a question or comment, Sarah, we were talking about getting employees to sign non-compete agreements, non-solicitation agreements, and I actually had an employee sign an agreement, and I've been through this before. I have signed a number of these in my past employment history, and I've seen some really good ones. And so I used that language, and I got this person to sign, and sure enough, this person violated that agreement, and actually it was a pretty egregious violation of that agreement. And I won't go into all the details, but I took that person to court, and the court agreed with me.
Yep. Did you win some damages?
No, but I got him to stop doing business for
a period of time. Well, I was going to say there's usually two sides. One is they damaged me by taking my clients. The other
right.
is they damaged me by making me go to court and enforce
it. That's an excellent point, Sarah, that I'm glad you brought up, because proving damages
is hard.
Yeah. Getting them to stop and to fulfill the agreement, which is to not do business within these parameters for a period of time within a certain geography,
mm-hmm.
that's more provable and defendable.
Yes, absolutely. There's three levels to those non-competes. The first level is just saying that you will not give away the information, like especially client lists.
Right.
to a competitor of mine, and that's fairly easy to enforce, and the damages are fairly easy to prove on that. You gave the information, I lost that client,
right,
to your new employer.
Mm-hmm.
The second level is what we call a non-solicit. A non-solicit says you're not going to solicit, you're not going to go after the clients that I introduced you to, especially important when you've got people working off-site on a client's premises,
right,
because you're not going to have that relationship with them that the person on the premises is. So you want to be able to stop them from going after the clients you've already developed.
Right.
The third level is you can't even go into this same business that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the higher level that's much more difficult to enforce. Don't neglect the two lesser ones because they actually give us the most amount of protection in court. Those two are fairly simple, number one, to prove, and number two, to enforce and get the person to stop doing.
You know, Sarah, you mentioned a minute ago that it's difficult to get someone who has been in this industry, in your industry for a while, to enforce an agreement with those people. But in today's world, in order to get someone like that to go to work for you, you're going to have to pay them a premium, probably.
Yeah, absolutely, a premium or a bonus or
exactly.
a promotion. It's
right.
Not a valid contract unless something is given in exchange at the time that they signed it. Either their new employee, in which case the job itself is the new exchange, or they've been given some sort of bonus or promotion or change in status.
Well, the thing that I wanted to mention is that when if you're saying, okay, I'm going to go ahead and pay you this money this increased salary that you want, it's more than I want to pay, that's when you negotiate the agreement.
Absolutely.
The non-compete agreement, because you're giving them something, you're probably paying them a premium for their time and for their services, and so get the agreement. And to me, that's another reason, another way to justify the agreement.
Absolutely.
Let's move on down and talk about understanding the at-will status. Tell us what at-will means. We've talked about that in the past on the show, but I'd like to revisit that.
Well, first of all, this is something that's different from state to state, but you will find in most states in the union, being employed is what we call at-will, meaning it's at the will of the employer. You can be fired for any reason or no reason at all, except for the typically federally protected reasons, race, mm-hmm. religion, the
right.
ones we are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But just because if somebody is not doing a good job, their behaviors are not appropriate, their work performance is unacceptable, those are all certainly good reasons for firing somebody because they work at your desire. The opposite
right.
side of that is the employee can leave at any time. There's no requirement, unless you've got a contract with them that says differently, there's no requirement for the employee to give you notice or give you 2 weeks or give you 1 week. They can leave at any time as well. So it goes both ways, and people need to understand that, first of all, not to be afraid to fire people.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they are doing something which they know is wrong, and frankly, I think at this point we all know what wrong reasons for firing would be.
Exactly.
But, do not be afraid to fire people just because firing causes lawsuits. It doesn't.
Right.
It's non-documentation that causes lawsuits.
Exactly. Stand by, Sarah. We're going to take a break. Folks,
okay.
It's 29 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Sarah Calvert is our special guest, and our phone number is 888-822-8255. Hi, welcome back, heroes. It's 33 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, a Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. And our phone number is 888-822-8255. And our special guest is Sarah Calvert. She is a small business attorney. She's the principal in Calvert and Associates PC, a small business law firm out of Fairfax, Virginia. And Sarah, I know you have an 800 number, but there are people listening to this show who are within rock-throwing distance of you who may want to use your services. And I would like for you to give us your 800 number and your local number.
Okay, as long as they promise to throw no rocks.
Okay.
The 800 number is 800-526-5665. And the Virginia number is 703-591-5315. So feel
okay.
free to give a call to say you heard me on this show, and I'll answer questions for you.
Great. And maybe even give them a little bit of a discount?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The special Small Business Advocate discount.
There you go.
Twice
let's move on. Let's move on down and talk about another issue that you've got in your list of 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business, and that is the question, do you know the difference between an independent contractor and an employee? Now, a lot of people would say, of course I know what the difference between a contractor and an employee, but it may not be that easy these days because the employment landscape is changing, and it may be more difficult than you think.
Well, let me tell you what the secret to all of this is. The states that we live in make money when we have employees.
Yep.
They lose money when we have independent contractors.
And they don't like losing money.
And they do not like losing money. The state I live in, Virginia, happens to be one of the forefront leaders in hiring Rottweilers to come out and find people that could be possibly classified as employees. We can write all the contracts we want. We can define people all we want. But unfortunately, the ultimate arbiter of whether somebody's an independent contractor or an employee is the taxing officials, both the IRS and your state taxation people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always to their benefit to make this person an employee. So my rule of thumb is if it looks like an employee, you're far safer making it an employee than having somebody retroactively go back and charge you FICA
mm-hmm.
and penalties and interest.
That gets ugly.
No, it's very expensive. I was giving this seminar once to a group of people in somebody who was a doctor's office stood up and said, well, you know, I've got an office manager and I haven't been paying everything correctly and I've been calling her an independent contractor and I'm afraid, maybe she's really an employee. Well, she sure sounds like one.
you can quit being afraid.
And about 6 weeks later when he fired her, she went to try and collect unemployment, which only employees can do.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yes, indeed, she may collect, and as a matter of fact, you owe us some FICA.
Well, okay, look, now, folks, in that case, that's obviously, that person is obviously an employee. She
yeah.
comes to work every day, she clocks in, or so to speak, or
mm-hmm.
whatever, and this is where she works every day, she devotes her time to that. But there are other cases, Sarah, you and I know this, that where the person is sort of a contractor,
mm-hmm.
but because of the way the relationship is structured, in effect, they are an employee. For example, if I'm doing work for you in my home, even in my home or whatever, if I'm doing work for you part-time, and I'm calling myself a contractor, I'm saying that I'm a consultant or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but isn't it true that if you're the only client, quote, client, unquote, that I have, that could actually be construed as, instead of me being an independent contractor, I am your employee?
That's absolutely true, and there's a few ways to get around that. Number one, make sure that the independent contractor has a business license or whatever mm-hmm. licensing requirements are required in your local jurisdiction.
With a tax ID number.
With a tax ID number. Best of all, of course, is to get them to incorporate, which would be to their benefit anyway. If we go back to number one on my list of 101
right.
ways,
right.
Best of all would be to have them incorporate. But if they don't incorporate and they're going to act as a sole proprietor, make sure they're a legal, legitimate business. Make sure they've got business cards with their business name on it. Make sure that they have stationery. Make sure they invoice you and you just don't send them money.
Right.
There needs to be an arm's length transaction with this person. And that starts to develop the independence that is needed in order to make sure that person is not called an employee of yours.
Haven't there been cases where the client thought that they were dealing with an independent contractor, when in fact, as we were just saying, the way they were working with this company, they were actually the only client this independent contractor had, and the company wound up having to pay back payroll taxes for that person.
Even though they believed all along this.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's very hard because unless you really question your independent contractors. Small business people don't like to admit that you're their only client.
Right.
You're the only one I've managed to lasso into using my services, but I'm still looking.
But if you work with these people enough, you can tell.
Yes. Yes.
You can hear them. Now in my situation as a business consultant, I don't tell my one client about that I'm working for another client.
Right.
But they come to my office. They see other things going on. They can
sure.
tell. They can tell what's happening. And you don't work with these people as closely as you will without realizing what's going on.
And so long as it appears that you have a business plan, that you are out marketing to other people, and that you've taken those steps to become a legitimate business, those independent contractors should be fairly comfortable at being an independent contractor. Now, there are situations where someone can be an employee of multiple corporations. The flip side of this question is there are people who actually become employees for three or four different entities.
Yeah, exactly. And folks, this is an important issue. The reason we're dwelling on it a little bit is because more and more, Sarah, this is happening as more and more people are downsized and they go out on their own.
Absolutely.
Stand by. We've got to take a break. It's 39 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Sarah Calvert is our special guest. I'll get my mouth working in a minute. 888-822-8255. All right, we are back. It's 44 after. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and Sarah Calvert is an attorney. She's a small business attorney out of Fairfax, Virginia. She specializes in helping small business owners accomplish their goals, and I appreciate her doing that. And we're talking about 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business. Before we move on, though, Sarah, I wanted to mention that today is National Nurses Day. Did you know that?
Oh, no, I didn't. Congratulations, nurse.
Hug a nurse today.
Absolutely. They're wonderful people.
My daughter is an RN.
Ah.
And so this is a special day for me. So be sure to hug a nurse today, folks. And they do good work, and we couldn't do without them. Sarah, let's move on down and talk about contracts in our 101 ways to avoid liability in small business. Written agreements, contracts with your clients or your customers are critical, aren't they?
They are absolutely critical. If you've ever heard a real estate person say location, location, location is everything, my theory on this is that document, 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 everything. This will save your behind in a general scope on everything. In the 101 ways, it comes down to documentation. And this is your first line of defense for documentation. People, it doesn't happen as much anymore, but especially government contractors or people who do consulting work for a living say, all my deals are done by a shake of a hands, a fax, somebody says do this, and I just start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry about those people because the scope of the work that they're doing is not clearly outlined. How to get into it and how to get out of it is not clearly outlined.
Right.
And what happens if something goes wrong is not clearly outlined. So those are the kinds of things I want people to be very clear about. And then their rates and how they charge and expenses, all those things need to be clearly documented.
Right.
That doesn't have to be a 25-page agreement. Most good agreements can be on 2 to 3 pages. You know, if I'm writing it, it's 30. If you're writing it, it's probably 2. And what our goal is just to make sure that everybody is very clear up front with what the circumstances of this arrangement are going to be. This means that, number one, if you say green widgets and I hear red widgets, somewhere in writing is what kind of widgets we're talking about.
That's right.
Number two, they're to be delivered, and I'm supposed to pay for the shipping, and if they get broken, it's your fault. Then we know what happens if something goes wrong. We've got it all written down. Number three, I can't get green widgets, and so what do I do now? You've paid me. I can get green widgets in the next month. Is time important? Is there a certain delivery date that's important?
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of problems, when they arise, are dealt with in the contract. And if I need to get out of the contract, what happens? Do I have to refund you all your money, or have you spent some of it? Can I keep some of it? How do I get out of this deal if I have to? Unfortunate and unusual things happen in contracts and in business relationships, and we like to have as much documented up front as we possibly can.
Now, also, if you're delivering something before it's paid for,
mm-hmm.
if you're affixing something to someone else's property,
mm-hmm.
then you have to be sure to have that kind of language in there to cover that because, for example, if you're a contractor,
mm-hmm.
and even if you take a deposit with a signing of a contract, and you're expecting to get the remainder of that contract, the other 75 or 80% or whatever of the contract, when the work is done,
mm-hmm.
if you're fixing something to someone's house or home or their business or their industry buildings or whatever, their grounds, then when you finish, if they don't pay you, what are you going to be able to do about that?
It's going to be very difficult to do any kind of collections without some sort of agreement up front. The courts accept what they call an open account where you just gave them your services, but unfortunately, it's extremely hard to prove. What the person you're suing usually says is, he told me it'd be $300, and when I got the bill, it was $500. That's
right.
That's most commonly the complaint that we see. You know, it's interesting out in the Oklahoma tornado disasters.
Mm-hmm.
The governor was saying to the small business community, please don't gouge our people. But the other side is true as well. Please don't hire a contractor, say you're going to pay, but it's an emergency and you don't have a way of paying right now, and then come to find out that you didn't have the insurance you thought you had or you didn't have some way to pay these people. Without contracts, both sides can find themselves in great difficulty.
Absolutely. And, Sarah, thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to stop for a moment and just to say to everyone to please keep the people in the families, obviously, in the plain states who have been hit so hard with these devastating tornadoes. But and I don't want to minimize the loss of life and the injury and the homes that have been destroyed, but I've got to think about all the small businesses out there who not only lost their business, But they lost their marketplace.
That's right.
Whole communities were wiped out by this tornado. And so you just think about that. What if everything around you were all of a sudden gone? The tornadoes that hit out there would absolutely, and I know I'm digressing here a little bit, but I just think we need to stop and think about some of those folks and do whatever we can to help them in any way. And obviously, not gouging them would be one good way to do that. But anyway, I'm glad you brought that up. That reminded me because I wanted to say something about that. I saw, and I'll just say one more thing. Those places, and I've seen tornadoes. I've been in the middle of where tornadoes have come through, and those places look like a nuclear. I don't believe if a nuclear bomb had been dropped, it would have looked worse.
Mm-hmm. Which makes us all think about our businesses. Well, what would we do? What would you do if you were in the World Trade Center and you couldn't get to your offices for a month?
Uh-huh.
That makes you want to have backup computers, backup tapes at home. It starts to make you put together a plan for your business as to what might happen in a tragedy.
It gives you a new appreciation for loss of business insurance, too.
Absolutely.
You know, that's something. I have that. I hope you check into that.
Yep.
Folks, it's 50 after. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Sarah Calvert. I'm Jim Blessingame, the Small Business Advocate. Stay with us. All right, we're back. It's 54 after. I'm Jim Blessingame, the Small Business Advocate. I want to remind you that coming up in the next hour, our good friend Joan Pride, associate editor with the Kiplinger Letters, is going to be with us to talk to us about the most recent Kiplinger Letter. And as always, it's a good one, and we're going to be talking about that coming up after the next break. Sarah Calvert is our special guest and our good friend. She is talking to us about 101 ways to avoid liability in your small business. Sarah is a small business attorney, and we're going to go off the sheet for the rest of this hour, folks, and get Sarah to talk to us about being a small business attorney, what it's like, but also how do you find a small business attorney? I guess maybe that would be the best thing to talk about right now, Sarah, is whenever there are people listening out there in California who are saying, I don't know any attorneys that work with small business owners. Mm-hmm. Most of us don't,
mm-hmm.
who work with small businesses. How do we find someone like that?
Well, you could probably start in your Yellow Pages or with your bar association if they've got a referral service and see if they have a category called small businesses. Now, unfortunately, these days, mostly what you'll find is business attorneys or corporate attorneys. And those two may or may not be related to a small business attorney. You may have to interview 5 or 10 or 15 attorneys over the phone or their staff or somebody who's familiar with their practice. They're like doctors. I think we're more familiar with the doctors. You go to an internist and a general practitioner, and that's all very well and good, but then he hands you or she hands you 12 different referrals to go to the specialist.
Right.
The small business attorney is really one of those specialists. We don't work with large corporations, and I'm not talking about dollar figure corporations. I'm talking about normally number of employees. Most of us, people that work with small businesses, don't work with probably over 200, 250 employees in a business because that's a different scope of business.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my clientele is anywhere from 1 to 10 employees. That's just the normal range.
Well, I'll tell you, you know what, something you and I need, a project you and I need to take on,
mm-hmm.
is we need to identify other attorneys like you across America.
And if there are any out there that want to call, terrific, give me a call at my 800 number because I'd love to know you and be able to refer you because all the time I have people calling me from out of the area, from a lot of the educational work that I do, saying, where do I find you in Arizona or Utah or
You North have Dakota? Heard, folks, you have heard Sarah talking about how she operates her practice. If you know someone who sounds like that, let us know who they are so we can let people know who they are. I want small business owners to be able to find people like Sarah, and that's the reason I'm so excited about knowing that you're available, Sarah, because I know how law firms work, and I'll be honest with you, I know a lot of lawyers across the country, and I don't know any that work exactly like you do, and it's very interesting. What are some of the challenges? I've got about 1 minute or less. What are some of the challenges, though, for you to do what you do?
Well, you have to have a lot of clients in order to make a small business practice. Some of my clients use me twice a year. Some of them use me once a month. Some of them use me once a week. Some need more handholding than others.
Right.
But basically, it's not there's not one firm that gives you a massive retainer that keeps you in business. So in order to do what I do, I keep the number of attorneys small. I have some backup attorneys But as far as full-time attorneys working for me, there aren't any, except I have my paralegals and my intern staff and my law clerks and my secretarial staff. So most of the work we do is transactional work. Most of my clients can't afford to be in court. So that we're fortunate in that, and it is not as expensive to be a transactional attorney as opposed to a litigator. But frankly, most of my clients don't want me to be a litigator. They want out of trouble, not into trouble.
Well, hopefully, if they come to you early enough, you'll be able to prevent them from having to have a litigator.
And that is the whole point of education, to be a proactive partner in the business.
Exactly. Well said, Sarah. Thank you very much. We're going to have you back again next week. We're going to continue our discussion.
Absolutely. Sounds like fun.
Thank you, Sarah. Had a good one today. You did well.
Thank you. Take care.
See you later.
All right.
Sarah Calvert, ladies and gentlemen. I've got to wrap it up for this hour. Before I go, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest country in the world. And remember today, be guilty of committing a random act of kindness. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Sarah Calvert. Sarah is.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.